Please be seated. Great. The first case for our argument this morning, this is not good. Cindy, do you have a volume control on this mic? Thank you. Okay, we'll try it again. A little more. Testing. That's good. Okay. The first case for our argument this morning is the Bituminous Paving Company, Appellant versus the Gettysburg School District, Appellee. For the Appellant, Bituminous Paving, we have Mr. Ronald Schmidt, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the Appellee, Gettysburg School District, we have Mr. Kenneth Barker, an attorney from Belle Fouche. The court would like to welcome students from Bonham and Mr. Naminga, and also welcome students from Gettysburg High School, Mr. Marlett and Mr. Scott. It looks like everybody got chairs, and that is just great. You can see when they built this building about 1900 that they didn't anticipate large crowds, but in those days I suppose the only way you got to the state capitol was by horse. So. With that, Mr. Schmidt, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Morning. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, if it please the court, it was and is the bituminous theory of this case that the school board's utter disregard of the condition precedental notice and claim provisions of its own contract bars its claims. And I would like to point out just preliminarily that the contract is an adhesion contract that was prepared by Helms, the school board's engineer. The engineer designed the project, let and awarded the contract, and inspected the work during construction. The contract specifically states...
Wait a minute, Mr. Schmidt. Was this bid?
Yes.
Well, then I assume your client knew what they were getting into when they put the bid in. They had the specs.
My point is, Your Honor, yes, but the client did not have any right to change or alter or modify any of the terms of the contract. It was a take-it-or-leave-it contract. There's no negotiation, therefore, in my opinion, it was an adhesion contract. But the point is, it was prepared by the board's agent.
You challenged it as an adhesion contract below, did you?
It was not. That was not great. Okay. But the point is, Your Honor, that the contract provided specifically in section 9.9 and 10.5 that the engineer was the sole judge of the acceptability of the work. The contract further provided that under section 10.05 there were specific remedies and notice requirements and opportunities for either party to go to the engineer with any claim. And the provision required 7 days notice, and it required a statement of the claim be provided to both of the parties in a hearing. And it provided that if either party objected to the engineer's decision, that then under those circumstances there's a due process right in the contract to appeal to a court on any and all claims, whether arising under the contract or law.
Well, now the school district also is alleging that the engineer is negligent for not perhaps doing all the stuff you're complaining of. So wasn't that negligence on that on the part of the engineer taken into consideration when the jury arrived at the percentage that your client was responsible for?
Well, interestingly, Your Honor, there's a provision in the contract that if the school board terminates the engineer, that the contractor has the right to agree to the new engineer. And the facts are this, and this is what I really want to focus on here. On April of 2004, the engineer Helms said to the school board there were some issues that carried over from 03, gave a definitive written proposal to cure these problems in April of 04. On May 10th of 2004, all parties, representatives of the school board, Helms, and Bituminous, went out and inspected the track thoroughly, came back, and the board's minutes will reflect that the board adopted Helms' proposal to cure all these problems. And gave, to cure all the problems, the board adopted a resolution, which is in evidence, that actually sets forth the requirements that Bituminous was to finish prior to August of 2004 to the satisfaction of all claims. The board entered into that agreement in the form of the resolution. On May 25, Helms memorialized it, the agreement, with a letter to Bituminous saying, here are the things you got to do, and you can do them anytime between now and August 15th of 2004. Shortly thereafter, unknown to Bituminous, the board met with a Mr. Sam Fisher, who was a track surfacing contractor, and Mr. Fisher said to the board, hey, you've got some subsurface problems out here, what Helms is recommending is not going to fix these problems. So at that point, on June 7th, the board met with Mr. Fisher, and on June 7th, as admitted in the brief of the district called Bituminous and said, you can't come back, directed Bituminous not to come back to the project, period. And at that point, Helms was not involved. There was no notice of what the subsurface conditions were. The school board knew the subsurface conditions and kicked Bituminous off the project. Now, what's further interesting is that under 13.9, which is what the school board says it proceeded under 1309, there again are various procedures. First of all, that section only comes into effect after the engineer has issued a certificate of substantial completion, which was never done. The school board testifies repeatedly that they never did anything. The 1309 requires that the board move expeditiously, get another contractor, do the repairs, and then can charge back those costs with a change order. That's specifically required in 1309. There was never any change order. There just was an absolute disregard of the contract. And as conditions in section 909 expressly states that the remedies in 1005 are conditions precedent to all claims.
How was this presented to the jury?
Pardon?
How was all this presented to the jury? Because didn't they make the final decision?
This was presented, Your Honor, in motions by Bituminous at the close of the plaintiff's case and at the close of all evidence for directed verdict or a judgment as a matter of law under the new term, based on failure to meet the conditions precedent of the contract, specifically citing the sections of the contract that were not met. It was presented on waiver and latches throughout trial. We argued, by the way, we did direct examination and cross-examination throughout the trial on these notice and claims issues without any objection. The motions were properly brought. We believe that those were issues of law for the court, and the court abused its discretion in denying those motions.
But did the jury...
So it never went to the jury. Those were questions of law.
So the jury never got an instruction on condition precedent?
No, Your Honor, because, first of all, condition precedent...
Did you offer one?
No, Your Honor, because it was not... That's a condition precedent is the burden on the plaintiff. It's not an affirmative defense. It's a burden, a special burden on the plaintiff to plead and prove compliance with all conditions precedent. It's the burden on the plaintiff, and the plaintiff did not plead, nor did it prove any compliance, and in actual the proof shows total disregard for the contract.
So the first time you raised this issue was after all of the plaintiff's evidence had gone into,
yes,
into evidence.
Properly.
So isn't there an argument that you waived it by not requiring it or not bringing this to begin with?
There's the burden, again, I try to repeat myself, but the burden, Your Honor, is on the plaintiff to plead and prove compliance with conditions precedent. It was not pled, and it was not proved, and timely motions were made. It was not an affirmative defense.
Was there an issue of fact as to whether or not, because they had given you notice on, you know, at least some substantial notice, because you'd gone out and repaired it a couple times, correct?
Well, but under Helms' direction and under Helms' proposals, and there were all of the punch list was completed in 03, except there were some patches around the high jump area that admittedly were not done properly.
So had they done what you say they should have done, rather than going under 1309 section, what would have happened differently?
Well, under 1309, if the seven-day notice had been given of the actual knowledge of some alleged subsurface conditions of some structural problems which the district had been told on June 7 existed, the county didn't even know that. They had no opportunity to respond. Under 1309, if it were followed, the district had a duty to give 7 days notice to Bituminous, here are some problems, and it would come from the engineer, and you got 7 days to do something about it or to initiate a plan and get it done. That was not in, that was just simply was disregarded. The whole contract was disregarded.
What are you saying, though? I mean, if they would have done what you're complaining that they didn't do, what difference, or where's the prejudice, or what would your client have done? What are you saying that you weren't able to accomplish because you weren't given the notice? Doesn't void the contract, does it?
Talking about the contract, the contract, actually, that's before this court, was the contract that was entered into on May 10th, 04, between the board, the district, and Helms. And that contract was rescinded on August 8th, 2005, by the board. If it weren't a valid contract, then why would the board, in a few days before starting the lawsuit, have rescinded that contract that Bituminous had until August 15th of 2004 to do the repairs that Helms said had to be done to comply with the actual contract? Now, again, what I can't emphasize too much, on June 7th, the board met with this third party, Mr. Fisher, who said you've got structural problems.
Well,
nobody told Bituminous what they were, that the fact they existed. Bituminous just said, don't come back.
Well, are you here today to try to argue that Bituminous did a good workmanlike job, or are you simply saying that doesn't apply because under the contract, Gettysburg is stuck with the results on a contract they drew?
No, Your Honor. What I'm trying to say is that Bituminous at all times complied with the contract, was ready, willing, and able, as testified by Mr. Byrie, to come back and do everything it had been instructed to do by Helms and the May 10 agreement and the May 25 directive from Helms. They're ready, willing, and able to comply. They've always complied with the requirements of the engineer under the contract. The fact is that on June 7, unknown to Bituminous and in violation of every provision of the contract, the school district just calls out of the blue and says you're directed not to come back to the job. They were given no opportunity to even address any alleged structural defects, to come up with a plan to fix it. The evidence is that had those problems been brought to Bituminous' attention, they would have been addressed. They were just simply out of the blue told don't come back to the project. And they had agreed a few weeks earlier, a few days earlier, to do everything the engineer told them to do to repair the project. And so we're saying that...
Will you kind of fill us in on what repairs they did do before this time?
Okay.
They'd been back a couple times before that?
Your Honor, the asphalt was laid in September of 02. And so later that fall, there was some cracking in one area where a roller had apparently cracked it or whatever. So The board, of course, the tract is a limited use facility. It's only used in the spring during the track season. So the board didn't want anything done during the track season. So in May of 03, the parties inspected the tract. A punch list was prepared. And then in August of 03, bituminous came and did all of the punch list items, except there was concern about the patching near the high jump. So again, the parties agreed that those would be, those issues would be addressed after the track season in 04. So in 04, they came on May 10th, inspected. Helms had given a proposal. Here's what Bituminous has to do to correct all these problems, you know, the remaining problems. The board entered into agreement, including compensation provisions. Helms gave Bituminous till August 15th of 2004 to accomplish everything it had been told to do. Bituminous was ready, willing, and able to do that, and then out of the blue are told, directed not to come back. Had no opportunity to address any of these alleged defects. Furthermore,
did you dispute that they were defects in the trial court level?
Yes, they were. I mean,
are you disputing that today? So my question is, if you thought that it would have been acceptable, then at some point, I mean, you would have arrived at a stalemate anyway, wouldn't you have at some point?
Not really, Your Honor, because Helms, as the engineer, did not even have the opportunity to look at the alleged defects.
Well, let's assume they had. What would have happened had you received the notice that you're complaining of not receiving?
The two of us would have done the work. If there, in fact, were alleged or were these subsurface structural problems, and they had been brought to Bituminous' attention, and the engineer on the contract has had a duty to do it, examined and said, yeah, we agree, and here's what has to be done. Bituminous was obligated to do that under the contract, but were denied that opportunity.
So was that presented to the jury?
Again, the condition, precedent, waiver, and estoppel arguments were made to the court as questions of law at the close of the evidence of the plaintiff and at the close of the evidence of the case. They were not fact issues. These are questions of law for the court, and they were not fact issues for the jury.
So what did you argue to the jury? That there was no subsurface problem with the foundations?
I don't think, Your Honor, all of the evidence and at trial, the school district had Mr. Fisher testified, and they had another expert, Dr. Hahn, and through cross-examination, we did question their findings, and we did question the damages. By the way, the damages, the school district, 1309 says this board has to act expeditiously to cure the problems in order to come in for attorney's fees and all these things and claim back. The board never did anything through trial. Not anything. The board didn't do one thing to look at or try to cure these problems. And even at trial, the damages were speculative. The two experts had vast disagreement. Those are other issues in the case. By the way, I realize limited time. I won't be able to cover all of the issues, but we rely on the brief in those regards. So.
Sure.
What percentage of, assuming we're talking about 400 meters or 400 yards of a track field, is that right? Was it a track 400 meters or 400 yards?
I honestly don't recall, Your Honor. It was a standard track, high school
okay,
track.
Okay, but what percentage by the experts was claimed to be deficient as to the subsoil?
That was a dispute as to the testing. For example, there was some question on elevations, and the expert had done the survey in February when the ground was frozen and tried to compare that to other elevations that were taken when the ground was not frozen, and there was all sorts of disputes on the expert's testimony, and the jury did find that Bituminous was 70% at fault. I don't know how that would translate to percentage or whatever, but I think that was a real fact issue.
But nothing was
nobody said it's a half of the track or it's three-fourths of the track or I think it was more isolated spots.
Thank you.
Going back to the condition precedent, Helms was never removed and a substitute engineer installed, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So if the school district is suing both Helms and Bituminous, how can you require them to enforce those conditions precedent when they're suing the very engineer that you want to have determine the nature of the defects and certify those?
Thank you, Your Honor. The point is that the contract, and we all believe in the sanctity of contract, but the contract is controlling, and the contract states specifically that it's the engineer who is the ultimate judge.
But if you're suing him, saying that he's negligent, he can't do the job, didn't do the job, isn't doing it right, how can you enforce that kind of a provision and say, I'm suing you, you're negligent, but yet you have to certify that it's right, and I'm going to rely on you?
Well, I think that's a key point I'd like to address. The contract gives the school the right to fire the engineer and the right to hire a new engineer, and at the point that the school board thought that this engineer wasn't serving it, it should have fired that engineer, brought in a new engineer, and by the way, as I mentioned, under the contract, the Bituminous had the right to actually agree to any new or substitute engineer. And I think it doesn't make sense that they would sue the engineer and not terminate the engineer and not get a proper engineer back at the time to really evaluate the question if they doubted the engineer. They'd never terminate.
Your time has expired, but I believe Justice Marion has a question.
Couldn't your client have also asked the engineer for the report?
The first my client knew of any issue, of any problem, was the phone call directing him not to return.
But couldn't your client at that time say, no, under the contract, here we want the engineer to give us this report?
Well, hypothetically, possibly, but they had been terminated by the owner, and the owner said, and by the way, there are termination provisions in the contract which were utterly disregarded. So the directive not to return, I mean, if I'm contracting with somebody and they tell me, don't come back,
okay,
you've got an issue, and I don't believe, as a practical matter, at that point in time, the Bituminous had an effective remedy. They were told not to come
back.
And
the request, or the thing that you're saying they didn't request, was an issue, or was a certificate of completion?
No, what I'm saying is that Section 1309 that the board relies on, Section 1301, says it only applies after substantial completion. And after the engineer issues a certificate of substantial completion, the engineer is done. And then that provision gives the owner certain rights and obligations.
Your time has expired.
There had never been a certificate. In fact, the school board...
You're done.
I am. Thank you.
Barker, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, members of the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen. Superintendent Marlette is here. He was the district's representative at the time of trial, and we're also privileged to have the senior class of Gettysburg High School. Your Honors, I just heard this morning in this argument from Mr. Schmidt that the key resolution to this case is the interpretation of the contract. Mr. Schmidt, however, fails to discuss the key provision of which the district sued this case. 17.3, Section 17.3 of the agreement states as follows. Cumulative remedies. The duties and obligations imposed by these general conditions and the rights and remedies available hereunder to the parties hereto are in addition to and are not to be construed in any way as a limitation of any rights and remedies available to any of them which are otherwise imposed or available by law.
What does that mean?
That simply means Justice Sabers, that any remedy that we have available to us by law, whether we're the plaintiff or the defendant, we can pursue.
You can throw the contract out, stuff it in the garbage pail,
absolutely,
and go from there?
Absolutely not. The contract still has effective provisions, for example, the definitions provisions. What's the defective work? It's important that the contract be construed in its entirety, that parcels and pieces of it not be extracted and then applied for purposes of an argument after the fact. The contract provides, first off, under Section 10, which is the centerpiece of Bituminous's argument, is changes in work. Section 10 applies to defects in work that are observed by the engineer, the project engineer, during construction. Section 13 applies to acceptance of work after the fact, defective work that was later revealed. Section 16 and Section 17 are the remedies that are available to either party to this action in terms of seeking the remedies available at law. The timeline is extremely important here. I think Bituminous would have this court believe that this was contemporaneous, that this whole process took place immediately after the construction. The construction ended in September of 2002. Bituminous didn't even show up on the project until it was 23 days into a 47-day time period or contract period. It was half behind before it ever got to the site. When it finished its paving on September 6th of 2002, within days after its completion, members of the school board, members of the public said, "What's wrong with this? We're seeing cracks appear. There's defects in the surface. What's wrong?" On October 22nd, within a month and a half after completion of the project engineer wrote a letter to Bituminous and said, what's up with this? We're having problems. What are you going to do about it?" They delayed doing anything, any even inspection of it, until the following spring in May of 2003. At that time, a punch list was issued, and Bituminous was told, get out there and get these things corrected. They didn't show up until August of 2003, and that's when the defective repairs were made. The question was asked about the timing, and it wasn't until nearly a year after the project was completed that the repairs were made. At that time, then, it was made even worse. So once again, the engineer sent a notice saying, "Listen, this is unacceptable. Come back again." That resulted in a meeting again in the spring of April of 2004. In April of 2004, another punch list. By this time, the conditions were growing worse. The depressions were worse. They were more noticeable. And Bituminous was again told to get out there between May and August and get this done. They didn't show up. In the meantime, Mr. Fisher shows up at the request of the school board. Mr. Fisher, certified track builder, builds tracks all over the United States and North America continent. These are Olympic quality tracks, but he's built them at several schools in South Dakota. He says, "Listen, these defects that you're seeing on the surface are only the surface of the problem. It seems to me, just looking at what the nature of the problem is, that there's something underneath here. And you ought to look closer." It was at that time that Superintendent Bjorkman picked up the phone call and said, "Listen, Bituminous, we think that there's more problems here. You better not come back." By that time, Bituminous now claims that we should have received written notice, we should have had an opportunity to come back and repair. They had had many opportunities to come back and repair.
But the point, I guess, is Bituminous was never notified of the Fisher opinions, at least notified through the formal process of certification by the engineer and all that type of stuff.
That is correct, Justice Hendrick. It is incumbent, if you read the contract, it's incumbent upon Bituminous to request from the engineer a certificate of completion. It never did that. It never did that.
And they gotten paid?
And they got paid. They got their final payment. They did get their final payment, right, Your Honor. And this kept going on and on and on. And finally, and the answer to your question is no, they did not receive actual notice of the structural defects, but it's not required.
It's not required because of a contract provision?
It's not required, yes, because of 1703. All other remedies are available to us. We could pursue an action at warranty, a breach of contract or negligence, which we did. So that answers that question, I think. In terms of
so at some point, the board just decided this contract's been breached and proceeded from there. Once you say the contract is breached, do any of the provisions come into play once one or the other party says it's breached?
Yes, because 1703 says apply this section, 1703, to any of the other sections of the contract in the event that there's a legal dispute. In terms of the remedies available, all the remedies are available, but in terms of attorney's fees, prejudgment interest, cost, and disbursements, apply this section because all the remedies are available to you. And I want to center on the issue of condition precedent because it seems that that's a centerpiece of Bituminous's argument here this morning. It is an affirmative duty by statute that Bituminous plead the failure of a condition precedent. Under 15.6.12b, there is an absolute duty by Bituminous to affirmatively plead all legal or factual defenses that they have to the claim. We made the contracts, both the contracts with Helms and the contract with Bituminous, a part of the contract, a part of the complaint.
So when's the first time you knew about their claim of condition precedent?
Thank you for that question. The first time I knew about it was after the evidence had already been presented to the jury in the post-trial motions.
I thought there was a pretrial motion on this. I thought Mr. Schmidt said there was a pretrial or a pre-jury motion. You don't recall one?
I don't recall one, and I reviewed the record, and my memory may be faulty, but I don't remember even an instruction being proposed on this issue. And I think it's incumbent upon the defendant to propose instruction and also bring it, alert it to the court. This is trial by ambush. The other question is, and I think it was brought up in the earlier presentation, is what prejudice can you show? What prejudice can Mr. Smith show that for some reason the issues weren't tried fairly to the jury in terms of the condition precedent? I differ with Mr. Smith with respect to whether the jury had an opportunity to consider this argument. Instruction number 37, proposed by Bituminous, reads as follows. You are instructed that Plaintiff Gettysburg School District is not entitled to be compensated for work that remained unfinished if you find Bituminous Paving was willing to perform such work but was ordered off the job and not allowed to complete the work. My reading of that is the jury got an opportunity to consider that issue anyway. The jury also was instructed that Helms is an agent of the district for purposes of considering whether there was contributory negligence. The issues of contributory negligence were instructed, the jury was instructed on those issues and fairly considered. So I think it's a hollow argument to stand here before the court and say somehow we were prejudiced by the fact that a condition precedent wasn't pled. First off, it doesn't apply. It's not required. Secondly, if it is required, it's required of the Bituminous, not of the plaintiff. And thirdly, even if it does apply and it wasn't pled, the issue was still fairly considered and instructed with the jury. And the
Did
jury,
that instruction say wrongfully ordered off the job?
No, Your Honor.
Read it again, if you will.
Sure. You are instructed that Plaintiff Gettysburg School District is not entitled to be compensated for work that remained unfinished if you find Bituminous Paving was willing to perform such work but was ordered off the job and not allowed to complete the work. This was an instruction that was proposed by Bituminous, and we that's cited in the record. The defects were substantial. Another issue about the lack of notice. If anybody was unfair.
So, just so I'm understanding, you're saying that jury instruction cures the argument?
What I'm saying is it does in part, but it represents, Justice Meyer-Henry, is the fact that the issue was fairly considered, decided, argued, and presented to the jury. And the jury decided against Bituminous.
On that point, though, then in the trial itself, did Bituminous put into evidence the contract and argue to the jury about 10.05 and 9.09 and all that?
Extensively.
Okay.
The contract documents were an extensive part of the trial, presented by both parties in fairness to Bituminous. We argued as well. What we centered on is what were required of the contracts. In fact, in that point, Justice Sinner, what I think is important to note here today is if anybody was disadvantaged by lack of knowledge, it was the school district. It wasn't until we had discovery in this case did we reveal what Bituminous should have already known. And that's another point on the issue of condition precedent. They knew when they laid the they actually ground up the old track, and in grinding it up, laid a subbase. They applied it unevenly. They ran out of material. They didn't do their engineering. They didn't do their contracting and spread it evenly. And so it resulted in uneven surface and uneven compaction. When they then put the gravel base on top of that, the test results, the compaction test, showed that that was again uneven. In fact, the day before they laid the asphalt, 10 of 18 compaction tests failed. And lo and behold, those were the areas that are still prevalent today as areas of the track that can be used. Areas of track that are obviously defective. Then, when they laid the asphalt, in the asphalt itself, 7 of 10 compaction tests of the density test of the asphalt failed. When we went back, Dr. Han, who is a noted paving expert from Minneapolis, who has written papers not only in the United States but also in China and consults with the Chinese government regularly on paving issues, tested the asphalt, and 7 of the 10 asphalt tests failed in terms of their density and compaction. They took 3 other test samples, but they were so poor they crumbled. When we look at in terms of the structure itself, there were 26 points around a 400-meter track to answer that question. Back when I was running track, it was 440 yards, but it's a 400-meter track, standard track. 26 points around that 400 meters were measured. And of those 26 points, 18 had a negative slope, which simply means this. It sloped the wrong way. 18 of 26. 26 of 26 points had depressions or crowns or other defects in the running surface. The surface is so bad that the senior class of Gettysburg High School that is represented here today has never had an opportunity to have a track meet on that track because it was shut down 2 years after construction. They use it for a walking, the community uses it for a walking track. They can't do anything at a faster speed than a walk safely. It was out of concern of the people that use it, the kids that use it, that they can no longer have track meets there. That's how defective it is.
That raises another issue we haven't talked about today that I have a question about. Do I understand that the track was not repaired at the time of trial?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, then my question is on prejudgment interest. And if that's the case, it seems to me that all the damages are future damages. And you got prejudgment interest on those damages.
I respectfully disagree. And the reason why is that the district paid for the track when it was constructed. And Bituminous has had the use of that money since then. And I think under the court's decisions that are pretty clear, the Sutliff decision in particular, says that if you've had the use of that money all this time, then you owe prejudgment interest. And Bituminous would like to muddy the water about joint tortfeasor liability and the fact that it can't be calculated, but I think this court in Sutliff clearly set out what the procedure was and what the model was on how that was calculated. And if you will note, Bituminous hasn't complained about the calculation. They don't complain about how it was calculated. They've made no record. There's been no objection of how we calculated the prejudgment interest. The only record that was made is that we're not entitled to it.
But your evidence was cost to repair.
Correct.
And that's yet to be done.
That's absolutely right. And the reason why is we don't have the money to do it. We have to get the money in order to make the repairs.
So isn't that future damages?
I think it's past damages because we've already paid the money. I understand your question, but I think if the money's been paid, the district has to have the use of it. And I think under the liberal standards that this court has applied for prejudgment interest, the very liberal standards, it says that if you've taken our money and you've had the use of it all this time, you owe it. If a jury later determines that you're required to pay it, then you should pay it. And so I disagree with Mr. Schmidt's position that that's future damages. I think that's the very definition of damages as is reflected in a construction scenario.
Can I raise another issue with you? Was the jury instructed on the provisions of the Uniform Commercial Code applying here?
Yes.
And why?
Because we pled it, and because there was also a warranty provision under the contract, and there was evidence to support the fact that within that one-year warranty period, bituminous didn't perform. There was an issue of whether...
Did the warranty provision in the contract cite to the UCC as being applicable? Because you're talking about sale of goods, I think. You know.
Well, it's a sale of mixed goods and services, but primarily goods. The evidence to support... The answer is no, Justice Konecamp, that it did not cite to the UCC. It just said that within a year, bituminous doesn't perform its obligations.
Is that a standard? I guess my question, my concern is here, this is a construction contract. I'm not familiar with construction lawsuits where the UCC is used on a sale of goods, which is primarily a service contract. Do you have cases that where the UCC is enforced against a contractor in a construction contract case?
I believe the case that we cited was the South Dakota Building Authority case, but I remember the principle of the cases that were cited, and that is this, is if it's a mixed issue of goods and services, look at what is predominant in terms of what's provided. In your cases that you cited, they use the example of an artist using oil to make a print, a picture, and then somebody installing a water heater, and whether that was a service or a good. Well, I think the analogy here is the water heater. We had service from bituminous. It was applied deficiently, but nevertheless, we end up with a product, and that's a track. And so it's kind of like the water heater, and that's the example that this court has used in the past, and that's the example I guess I would apply in answer to your question.
Was there objections to those jury instructions on warranty?
There were. In fairness to bituminous, there were instructions on the.
If the warranty instruction would not have come out of the UCC provision of the pattern jury instructions, would it have been different on just a general implied or an express warranty? I mean, what's different about the UCC express or implied warranty other than just a contract of mercantility of what you bought or purchased?
I don't think there's anything different. In fact, I just went to the South Dakota pattern jury instructions because I felt that was the most appropriate instructions to apply to this situation, and that's what the instructions told me to do. So those are the ones I recommended, and those are the ones that the court applied. There are other instructions, though, where I think very clearly the issue wasn't properly preserved. And I've addressed those in our brief, but the waiver and estoppel issue, for example, there was never an instruction on the waiver and estoppel proposed by bituminous. The issue of a prejudgment interest, there was never an objection made on the record to the instruction for prejudgment interest proposed by the district. Again, it can't be trial by ambush. This court has said repeatedly over the years that the purpose of our rules is to make sure that everybody has a fair opportunity, meaning the other parties and the judge, so that if there's an error made, we can correct it.
Your time has expired, Mr. Barker. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. There are some points I just simply want to rebut quickly, if I might. On Justice Meyer Henry's point on once the contract is breached, does that, in effect, cure the problem? But the fact is, under the contract, sections 10.05, 9.09, it says if either party has a claim against the other, you have to go under the contract procedures, give notice, so on. And 10.05 specifically sets forth some very due process requirements. After the engineer has made the decision, then and only then can an aggrieved person go to court on claims, and it says, and I quote, under the contract or law. So when you talk about section cumulative under 1701, that has to be tied together with 1601, which sets the remedies and procedures and the conditions for actually preserving and protecting and perfecting going to court. And 1601 incorporates 909 and 1005. And so if either party has a claim, they can't just say, oh, we breached the contract. There's a duty under the contract to follow the claims procedure, give the engineer a chance to resolve it, and if you're aggrieved, then you can go to court. Then and only then, as a condition precedent, can you go to court. Now, on condition precedent, the statute specifically burdens the plaintiff to plead and prove compliance with all conditions precedent. And the two cases, Farmer Seed and Feed and the Johnson v. Cross cases, address that. It's a duty is on the plaintiff. It's not an affirmative defense. There's no burden on the defendant in any regard in that.
Let me just ask you this, because if your argument about the condition precedent is, we buy that argument, what is the remedy? What's your remedy? What are you asking this court to do?
Okay. Under Johnson v. Koss and Farmer Seed and Feed, it states those cases stand for the proposition that if a plaintiff does not comply with conditions precedent, the claims are barred as a matter of law. It's a bar. Just as if an affirmative defense, if you meet that, that bars the plaintiff's claim. So it's the inverse of a an affirmative defense, and the cases stand for that. On the motions, Justice Inner, there was a motion made at the conclusion of the plaintiff's case, and that was renewed at the conclusion of all the evidence for a directed verdict on condition precedent under the specific contract terms, waiver, and estoppel. Those are the questions. There was no dispute of the evidence. There was no dispute that there had been noncompliance with the conditions precedent.
The first time that it was raised, the first time that the judge was told about this denial of a condition precedent was at the close of the plaintiff's case.
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason being that there's no duty, there's no obligation on a defendant to plead a lack of condition, but the burden is on the plaintiff.
Well, Rule 9C says that that the denial of a condition precedent shall be made specifically and with
clarity. And as I read the rule, in all deference to the court, it says that if it's pled, then a general denial puts the matter in issue. But it was never pled, and I don't have an obligation to cure a defect in the pleading of the other party. There's no obligation on that statute for the defendant to affirmatively do anything unless it's pled. And when the issue I examined and cross-examined on those issues without objection throughout the plaintiff's case and through the defendant's case, without objection, I timely made the motions as a question of law that the condition precedent had not been met, and that would bar, and it's a question of law, and that would bar the claims as a matter of law under those two cases.
What did the trial court actually rule when you made that objection?
Trial court denied the motions.
Just denied it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you don't know for what reason?
No.
So the trial court may have decided that they had met that provision by the notices or whatever, or we don't know why.
There were no notices. I think that's undisputed. The only, there was never any notice. They were just said, don't come back.
There were notices at some time, and you did repair it a couple
times. Oh, yeah, on the punch list, and the punch list were
the final payment.
I don't know. The engineer approved it, and I don't think there's any evidence in the record as to whether or not payment was actually made. I don't know. I assume it was, but I don't know. There's no record on that. The instructions, excuse me, on 17.3, the cumulative provision is subject to the 1601, which incorporates 909 and 10.5, which say that compliance with the claim provisions and the notice provisions are a condition precedent to coming into court. And if either party is aggrieved, then they can come into court on either contract claims or tort claims or whatever, and only then if the contract is read literally. On the UCC, Justice, there were objections to those instructions in the record, and we believe that, and the jury sent two notes on warranty. They were confused about it. We believe it was prejudicial.
Was there...
In Northern Farm Supply...
Counsel, if the UCC provisions had not been in and just the warranty provisions in the contract, would there have been different instructions to the jury?
That would have been the obligation of the board to propose appropriate, if there were in fact warranties under the contract or whatever, then there should have been some kind of warranty instruction, I assume, but that would have been the burden of the board.
But would it have made a difference, I guess is my question, if whether you use the UCC warranties or the warranties under the contract, would there have been a difference in those?
Yes, because the warranty of merchantability or whatever apply to sale of goods, and they have no relevance at all to a building contract.
And how would it have changed the jury, the wording of the jury instruction? How would that have been different?
Well, I guess there's an assumption that the board would have given some other instruction. I don't know if they would have been. All I know is they gave the UCC instructions, which we believe were highly prejudicial and confusing to the jury because they gave two notes saying, we don't understand this. We also believe that the tort claims were barred by 30% allocation of fault to the board, which is well briefed to this court. But back to the UCC, Northern Farm Supply case cited in our brief specifically holds that a building contract is not a sale of goods and is not subject to the UCC.
How do you say that 30% is ascribed to the board when it could also be subscribed to Helms?
Because there was a jury instruction, Your Honor, that specifically stated all of the acts and omissions of Helms are attributable to the board as agent, under agency law, and again, that's in the brief. But so,
but the 30% was not ascribed to anybody. It was all they did was ascribe 70% to Bituminous.
And that's the problem with the verdict form. The verdict form, Helms is still a party, but the only thing in the verdict form is for the jury to attribute fault to Bituminous. And there's no comparable line to attribute fault to Helms.
Did you object to the jury verdict form?
Pardon?
Did you object to the jury
yes,
verdict form?
Yes, I did, extremely.
Specifically what you're objecting to now, so the judge would have known that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, we don't really know, based on the jury verdict form, whether the jury found Helms 30% liable or the district 30%. I should say negligent.
And that's the problem. We don't know if the jury, the other 30%, is 100% the city, or if it's 100, or the school board, or if it's 100% Helms. Or we do know there was a jury instruction attributing all of the fault of Helms to the board, and that instruction was not objected to. So,
difference would that make, counsel? As I understand it, the jury found your client liable on three other theories, contract theories, warranty and breach of contract. So what difference would it make if they were faulty in finding them guilty or partly guilty on the negligence?
The only contract claim was breach of warranty, and we've talked about that. The only tort claim was negligence, and the and this court has held that 30% contributory negligence, 30% allocation of contributory negligence bars the claim as a matter of law.
But only on negligence. You still have a judgment against your client on breach of contract.
Only on the warranty theory, and we believe that the warranty theory was skewed by the improper instructions and
wasn't
the jury's
question. Wasn't there a breach of good faith and fair dealing? Wasn't that the finding on that too? Didn't that go to the jury also?
Yes. But again,
you can finish your answer when your time has expired.
Yes.
The court is in recess for 10 minutes.